You're listening to Civic Media. You can tune into any of our live shows on any radio station across the state with the Civic Media app. Find us in your phone's app store and listen anytime, anywhere.
Everybody, happy Friday Eve. My name is Maggie Dawn. You are listening to The Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. And today we are celebrating Women's History Month. Throughout the course of the show, we've got a great lineup of guests. I'm going to take a particular focus on women in media because, let's be honest, until frankly fairly recent times in the arc of the broadcast media universe, there weren't a lot of us out here, certainly very few of us talking political smack every day on talk radio. But I wanted to start with someone who actually knows a bit about women's representations in culture and throughout history. Her name is Dr. Ulla Klein. She is a professor and head of the Women's and Gender Studies program at the University of Wisconsin-Oshkosh. She joined the University of Wisconsin-Oshkosh back in 2020. Boy, I bet that was an interesting time. And we're going to talk a little bit about women in literature and how that is a reflection of culture. But let's start with the basics, Dr. Klein. What is women's studies and why is it important?
So women's studies was the academic arm of the women's movement in the 1970s. It was a reaction to the fact that there were these activist women who were agitating for women's rights in the 60s and 70s, and they were, a lot of them were in college, and they were realizing that they had studied art history, they studied history, they studied literature, they hadn't learned anything about women. And there was even a big protest where a bunch of them burned their degrees as a protest because they were saying, well, I didn't learn anything about women authors, women artists. So they began to agitate to change that. And it started first with classes. And that happened here, actually. So the first, there were classes, right, in the UW system on women's literature, women's health issues. And then the programs started. And a lot of them started actually 50 years ago. So exactly 50 years ago, that academic year of 1974, 1975 was the first year you could declare a women's studies minor at UW-Oshkosh.
So we're celebrating an anniversary as well. How fortuitous.
Yes.
Certainly throughout the course of my higher education, it was very remarkable to me. One, as an economist, I had very few women professors in the econ department. But even in my studies of literature and history, there's often sort of this gaping absence that is quite noticeable. I was fortunate enough to have professors that were very intentional about at least helping to provide footholds for anyone, not just women, anybody who is interested in, well, what was happening for women or people of color or other folks that that we weren't reading about in some of our literature classes. So when we talk about this in terms of a liberal arts education, can you help people understand that may not be predisposed to embrace what women are bringing to the table in terms of the study of history, culture, and literature? Why is it important, one, to have a good liberal arts basis of education? And secondly, why understanding women's role throughout the course of history and as reflected in these various art forms is absolutely essential, that you really have an incomplete understanding without it?
Well, I think a liberal arts education, I mean, it's about being able to enjoy life. I mean, life can't be just facts and statistics, right? That would be terrible.
Yes.
It can't just be work, right? It can't just be the day to day, Right. I was literally just talking to my students about this as part of our class. We actually took them. I took them to the gallery on campus to look at an exhibit of prints by women. And I think it's so important to have that. And we talked about how just life-giving it is to have creativity in our lives, to be able to appreciate art and literature. There's this big kind of like discourse in our world right now, like, oh, you know, don't go to college, go to technical school, be a plumber, be an electrician. And I'm like, that's great. You know, it's great. Go to technical school, be a plumber, be an electrician, be a carpenter. Those things are wonderful. But you can be a plumber and still enjoy Shakespeare. And I think you should do that. I think everyone should have an opportunity to develop an appreciation of art and literature and music. Those things are what make us human. You know, I'm a humanist. So yes. I think that that's really critical. And I think, you know, just look at babies, right? Babies start to bop to music mm-hmm. when they're like 6 months old. It's part of who we are, right? Being able to understand the world around us, being able to think critically about things, being able to have those conversations about anything in the world. I think that's part of being human.
Yes.
And it gives us that value added to our experience. And when you don't understand what half the population is bringing to the world, then again, like, those voices are not being heard, right? And it's also an imperfect picture of the world around us. Women have contributed so much to our world. And in that same class yesterday, we read Alice Walker's beautiful essay, In Search of Our Mother's Gardens, where she asks us to rethink art, right?
Yes.
She says, you know, my mother had this gorgeous garden and she made our poverty feel less poor because she brought this beauty into our lives. And you wouldn't always think of gardens as art because it's not a painting on a wall that lasts forever. It's this thing that you have to remake every year, but it's art. It's beautiful and it takes a lot of work. And, you know, I asked my students, how many of you have mothers and grandmothers who are artists? And, you know, no one raised their hand. And then I asked, well, how many of you had a beautiful birthday cake? How many of you had, you know, decorations for holidays? How many of you had female relatives who sewed you clothing or knitted you a scarf? You know, those things are things of beauty that enrich our lives. And, you know, let's not discount that. You know, we can have different definitions of art and artistry that enrich our lives. And women's art is sometimes different than what we have been taught to think of it. Beyond that, you know, there have been, sorry.
No, go ahead, Dr. Clark.
I was just going to say, you know, like, you know, Hedy Lamarr, the actress, like created like the version of Wi-Fi that we need for our phones. And Ada Lovelace created the first computer. And Rosemary Watson, you know, created, you know, sequenced DNA. And we had women who've been to space. And we've had women who identified comets in the 19th century who are astronomers. And, you know, there's all these women who contributed to the sciences and technology that we just haven't been taught about. There were women who fought in wars, who led armies, and we just have this persistent story that women just don't do those things. And so I think women's studies helps us kind of find those stories and those voices and also to change our way of thinking about what women can and can't do.
Change our way of thinking in a much more, what I would offer is a complete understanding, a much more expansive view, not just of our shared histories, inextricably intertwined histories of men and women and culture and science and technology, right? In a way that allows you, I think, to better understand your place, man or woman or someone that embraces they, them pronouns, right? To understand your place in the world, having this more complete, really more expansive understanding is so central. I remember when I was a baby lawyer in New York and I was practicing in securities litigation, which one would think would have absolutely nothing to do with art and history and culture. I had a partner come by my office at about 10:30 at night and proceeded to have a conversation with me that was about everything but the law. This partner wanted to know whether I understood all of this other stuff, what I'm going to call the liberal arts basis. Did I know about art and history and literature and culture? And what about that engaged me? That was their test of whether they wanted me working on their cases. They didn't want an automaton. They wanted someone that had all of the benefit of these complexities that are there for us to see and enjoy and study and be challenged by. And I think the idea that this is somehow an either or, right? Either mm-hmm. we're going to train people to be competent technical experts, or we're going to have people that don't want to engage in any sort of productive value add, as an economist might measure it, capacity in society if they're studying liberal arts, is a complete falsehood. You look at like one of the most astonishing and accomplished engineers, architects, and carpenters in history was Leonardo da Vinci, and most average folks wouldn't identify him as such. They would identify his art, but he was mm-hmm. all of those things. Mm-hmm. I wanted to ask you, you have a particular focus on 18th century British literature, which many of us throughout the course of our high school and college years will touch in some way, shape, or form. The way that women are represented, yes, so if we're fortunate, Dr. Klein, tell us a little bit about why that was your chosen area of study. We got just a little bit over a minute left. We'll, of course, pick it back up. But let's start with what about that drew you in as a specialty area?
Well, you know, it was the women. It was the women. They were so much more exciting than the Victorian women. You know, they were prostitutes and they were running around with they were owning brothel houses, and then they were also maids who were marrying their masters, and then they were falling out of carriages and had pet squirrels, and I don't know, it just seemed like a kind of crazy time. And then there were all these women in the 18th century whose stories were about like dressing as men and going in the army or going in the House of Lords, you know, sneaking in the House of Lords and or dressing as men and fighting duels. And I just thought that was also fascinating. And I just loved that. And I found it intriguing, and I was really into the Victorians, but that I read the 18th century stuff and I was like, no, this is
where I'm going.
Exciting.
Way yeah. more exciting. We're going to talk more with Dr. Ulla Klein, the director of the Women's and Gender Studies Program at the University of Wisconsin Oshkosh. When we come back, celebrating Women's History Month, we're going to talk about some of those specific women in 18th century British literature when we come back, and what it means for you today. What does it mean in our current political discourse? All coming up next, right here on The Maggie Dawn Show on the Civic Media Radio Network.
You're listening to Civic Media. Stay up to date on the latest news and information for your local community and Wisconsin by signing up for our free email newsletter. Visit civicmedia.us/email to get started.
I feel the earth move. Welcome back. Welcome if you are just joining us. My name is Maggie Dawn. You are listening to The Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. We're celebrating Women's History Month. Today, all show long, we're going to place a bit of focus on women in media, but that raised for me, again, a whole section of my mind about women represented in culture and literature, how we understand that, whether or not it's been part of our education, how it is valued or not. And I'm extremely happy to be joined by the director of the Women's and Gender Studies Program at the University of Wisconsin Oshkosh, Dr. Ulla Klein. Thanks again for making time. We were talking about one of your focus areas is the representation of women in 18th century British literature. And you were telling me it's because all of a sudden we went from this very like corseted Victorian stayed wig, you know, very constrained conception of women and especially how they were represented in literature yeah. into the 18th century, where all of a sudden women were doing all kinds of different things as represented in literature. And I wondered if you could give us a couple of examples of some of your favorite books or favorite characters from that period of time.
Sure. Well, on the cover of my academic book, Sapphic Crossings, is Hannah Snell, who was a real life person, actually. And we don't really know if today they would have considered themselves trans or just a woman who decided to pass as a man for whatever reason. Like, we don't know.
Maybe the additional rights and respect. Perhaps
yeah,
that might
yeah,
be
exactly.
an incentive to do that back then. Yes.
Yeah, we have no idea. But anyway, she was a real person who dressed as a man and joined the British Marines and actually fought on a warship and was in several battles, went all the way to India, all the way around Africa to India, and came back, and then told her story. And she was illiterate; she was from lower classes, but her story was written up by a publisher in London, and then it was published several times, both in a shorter version and a longer version. And all her exploits were kind of like described in a very sensationalistic manner, and it was published like The Female Soldier. And then she was also like, she would do her like soldiers exercises, like her military exercises with her gun, like on stage, and she made money that way. And later she owned a pub. But the big thing is that she was actually vouched for by her fellow
soldiers.
Marines, and
wow.
she got money from the British government for, like, she got her pension basically. Like they said, like, she really did do this and she was an amazing soldier. Or a Marine. Yeah.
How remarkable. I have not heard her story. I cannot wait to get your book, Dr. Klein. I'm always reading about four or five things at once. So this will get added into the queue. And it's interesting to talk about women in that period of time dressing as men. I was speaking mm-hmm. to a group of young women leaders last night, and a number of questions were about women adopting sort of stereotypical characteristics of male leaders in order to try to garner respect and to be seen as on equal footing of men. And I think women in many ways have at different points in our history, I think, felt compelled to sort of adopt masculine attributes, right? Or whether it's in dress or in style mm-hmm. of leadership, in order to perhaps gain some of those benefits that might be bestowed on men. This got me thinking, another area that you speak and lecture and think about a lot is women's body image in literature and in culture. Mm-hmm. I know today this is a topic of heightened awareness and concern for many of your students. Tell us a little bit about what your line of thinking is, and if you would like to, share some resources with folks.
Well, certainly social media has been kind of terrible at exacerbating this problem. I mean, technology has always had a negative effect, actually. Industrialization pretty much always has had this effect on women. So in the 19th century, this is when we start seeing like kind of a spike for the first time in things like anorexia with the rise of the industrial revolution.
Yes.
And so it kind of happens over and over again. Television, right? Again, mm-hmm. that happens. And then with social media, we see this effect happening again, especially the effects are especially extensive with teenage girls, right?
Yes.
Where the kind of things that you can do with photo changes, right? Kind of filters to your body, it has created an epidemic of depression and anxiety around young women and their bodies. And there's been some movement to have body positivity on social media, certainly certain kind of hashtags and things like that. But it's been a huge problem, unfortunately, that social media has kind of exacerbated.
When we observe this current political moment, Dr. Klein, where I think there seems to be a permission structure for extraordinarily stereotypical kind of aggressive male behavior and a re-embrace of very traditional roles and images, like the very way that women look. Mm. How does your work relate to that? Do you explicitly address politics in your teaching? How do you approach that as a professor?
I mean, we certainly talk about how women are represented in the political sphere and how they're discussed in the political sphere. There's the Misrepresentation Project, and the movie is a little bit dated at this point. It doesn't do anything that's beyond like 2012, unfortunately. But you know, the way that women are represented in politics has not changed, and we talk a lot about how the way that women are sort of demonized or sexualized in the media keeps women out of politics. And when that happens, then women are not part of the conversation and they cannot change anything because they are kept out of politics yet again. And that the focus on women's bodies and being pretty is another way to keep women occupied with something else rather than being part of activism, the political conversation, leadership, that these are misdirects yet again. These are all ways of keeping women out of power positions, of controlling them, their minds and bodies, so that they are not part of these conversations. So we definitely talk about it. And I'm a state employee. I can't endorse any politician, any candidate.
Of course not, yes.
But we talk about the importance of voting. We talk about the importance of political structures. We talk about what does it mean to be involved in today's day and age. And we talk about how women have been consistently disenfranchised as part of consolidating patriarchal power.
Thank you so much, Dr. Eula Klein. We will have you back. We will have a longer discussion about all of this. I could spend all afternoon talking with you. Thank you so much for your time. She's the Director of Women's and Gender Studies at the University of Wisconsin-Oshkosh. I'm going to talk to another fabulous woman, my colleague Jane Matner, about women in media when we come back right here on The Maggie Dawn Show on the Civic Media Radio Network. Keep it locked. Welcome, everybody. Welcome back. If you're rejoining us, my name's Maggie Dawn. You are listening to The Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. If you have been listening in, it is Women's History Month, and we're doing a bit of a special episode today, which I am so thrilled to be doing. And we're talking about women in media because, you know, up until not that long ago, women in media basically didn't exist. So when we talk about women's history and women that are trailblazers, certainly women in media has to come to the top of mind when we're talking about this general topic area. I myself, of course, a media neophyte. And so I have to look to those with a little bit more experience than I, but certainly there'll be some stories to share as I have spent a goodly amount of time in my career and basically environments and in legal practice areas and as an economist, which were no-go zones for women up until a few years ago. This half hour, I'm extremely humbled and very happy to be joined with my dear colleague and friend at Civic Media, the famous, the legendary, none other than Jane Matner, host of Matner on Air, which you can find on this wonderful network from 10 a.m. to noon every Monday through Friday. Welcome to the show, Jane. Thank you for making time.
Oh, thanks for asking me, Maggie. I am delighted to be here.
Let's just jump right in. What got you interested, not just in media or journalism, but radio specifically? Did you major in this in college or university? When did you get bit by the radio bug?
It actually started, I remember in high school, for whatever reason, and I always wanted to be an actress. This started off with my wanting to be an actress. And I blame this, I can go way back into my childhood, if you don't mind. We were,
Please.
I'm from a large Catholic family, and we were at Mass one Sunday, as we always were, and I was about 4 or 5, and there was a particular holiday within the Catholic Church, and there was a special service in which, at one point during the Mass, the priest says, "Let us kneel, let us stand, let us sit," and the whole congregation kneels and stands and sits as he says these things. And again, I'm very little, and I asked my mother after we went through all of that, apparently quite loudly, I said, "Why doesn't he make up his mind?" And the whole congregation burst out laughing. And I was.
Did the priest laugh too? I hope so.
I assume so. The whole congregation burst out laughing, and I was like, this is the greatest thing that ever happened to me. I don't know what I did. All I did was ask what I thought was a perfectly reasonable question. And then I got this great response. I need more of this. I need to figure out how I did that. And so that kind of set me on the entertainment path. And then I decided I want to be an actress once I get into college. And again, my father was a mortician. So being an actress was not a real job. To my father, the mortician, being a teacher or a nurse or even a secretary, that was a real job.
Something tangible.
And he had said when I went off to college to be an actress, he said, you might want to have a backup plan. Mm. And so at that point, I started thinking, radio, to me at that time, before the advent of cameras, where everything's everybody sees everybody now, radio to me was like theater. And that I could be anything anybody imagined me to be.
Yes.
I could do different voices. I could do different characters. I could be different things, and they couldn't see me. And so that to me, radio was just another different form of theater. And that's kind of how I ended up going into radio.
It's as you describe it, Jane. I've listened to you for a number of years. And just like when I've read books that have compelling characters, the character, the host, the radio host on air, the listener or the reader, in the case of especially fiction, you can sort of construct whatever you want. And it has this like deeply intimate personal element to it, because each person constructs the host or imagines the protagonist, in the case of fiction, differently, in a way that I think in this bizarre way is incredibly egalitarian and available to people, maybe in a way that theater or even TV and movies aren't, because you can only deal with the two dimensions that you see on that screen. Here, it's only limited by someone's imagination.
Exactly. Radio is theater of the mind.
Yes.
Radio is theater of the mind, where, again, as you said, you get to fill in the gaps with your own imagination. And that was one of the things that really appealed to me and made it so much fun. I mean, it used to be a big deal to see what a disc jockey looked like.
Right.
Which it should be.
Yes, I met Gene Miller, your former colleague, maybe like 3 years ago at an American Cancer Society fundraiser, and I was like, mind blown.
Right.
Not what I thought, until I heard him start talking, and I would just close my eyes and be like, oh yeah.
That's him.
That's Gene Miller
now. Yeah, exactly.
I can conjure up my mind's eye. Jane, let's get into the meat of today, however. So you start out as a young woman in radio and broadcasting. How welcoming, and I mean this with a heavy degree of sarcasm, how welcoming was the industry to women at the time, whether they were working behind the scenes in production or as talent on air?
It's interesting that you ask that, Maggie, and I've been thinking about this a lot, because colleagues here, and we share old radio stories. You know, back, I remember, I started in radio. I got my first job in 1981. I was 21 years old. And in my class at broadcasting school, out of the 25 of us in the class, 4 of us were women. Because at that point, it was very rare to hear a woman's voice on the radio. If you did hear a woman, she was the rock chick from 7 to midnight. That was the place where they got put. And that was originally what I wanted to be. I wanted to be the cool rock chick. Tragically, I was and am still not cool or a rock chick. So
you both, Jane. Cool, not a word that's like, used to describe me too often either. Yeah,
I tried it. Nah, but my general manager, when I started here in Milwaukee, heard me on the overnight shift after about 6 months and said, she's more than a laugh track. I want to put her in the morning. Mm. And so I got moved to mornings, and that's where I spent the vast majority of my career when I was in music radio. And then even later when I moved over into to AM radio and got into news and things like that. But it was a much different world. And a lot of times when I hear some of my friends telling old radio stories, And I had this revelation not that long ago. One of the reasons why I don't share mine is because so many of my stories are bad.
Yes.
I'm sorry, well, but it's true. That was my experience.
I'm sure we will have some story swapping here. I think being very candid and honest about some of the bad stories and the events as they occurred, the environments as they have been, what has changed, what has improved, what is still a problem is incredibly important because in my mind, if it's a problem for a woman, it's a problem for the overall business. And it actually, those hostilities or sometimes the lack of welcoming or the lack of openness of an organization or a media company is also making it that way for men in different ways, right? But the toxicity in any and all of its forms is bad for everybody. Buddy.
Yes.
Folks, if you're just joining us, this is my colleague Jane Matinair. She hosts the fabulous program from 10 to noon every day, Matinair on Air, with her great sidekick, Greg Bach, who is fabulous. We're talking about women in media. So let's talk about one of those stories, Jane. We've got about five or so minutes, so you've got plenty of time to give us the full Monty, if you will.
Sure. I will eventually. I'm hoping to one day write a book about this. I just need a couple of people to die first. So I can't mention some names, but I can tell you about what happened. I was about 30 years old, and I had just broken up with my boyfriend. And my general manager, where I was working at that time, knew about this. I believe I had talked about it on the air or something. And he said, let me take you out to dinner. You know, I know you're going through a rough time and just let me take you out to dinner and we'll have a nice dinner and that'll be great. I thought, how nice. That isn't that lovely. He's married and, you know, I'm newly single, but we meet at a restaurant about a mile away from where I was living. And I swear to God, I had not even taken a sip yet from my drink when this man sitting across from me, my married boss, says to me, Jane, I know how much you appreciate forthrightness. So I just want to tell you, I'm really attracted to you, and I want to know how you feel about me.
Oh.
Which at one, I'm trying not to do a spit take because that literally is not what I was expecting. And now it's like, how do I get out of this? How do I get out of this? So my go-to is always humor.
Yep.
That's kind of my defense mechanism in almost every situation, unless I'm faced with like a bear. But so
bear is not such great senses of humor.
That's probably not going to work so well. So I'm like, you know, if we do this, other people are going to find out. How is that going to work at work? And he's, oh, it's going to be fine. You know, nobody else is going to know about this. I said, but I'm going to know about this. And what makes you think, I said, I'm not going to ask for special favors from you. So this is a joke I still tell to this day about, Jane, what do you want? What do you want, you know, at this company? Yes. What can we do for you? And I always say, all I need is a limo and a fruit plate. And that's,
I love this line, and limo and a fruit plate.
And that is what I told this man. I said, if we start an affair, I want a limo and a fruit plate every day. Whacka, 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 ha, ha, ha.
I call this response that we sometimes do, and pardon me for the crudeness of it, is when I put on my tap shoes, right, and my jaunty cap.
Yes.
And like give them a little song and dance routine to distract.
Yes.
From the awkward, you have completely blown past any conceivable boss, subordinate, workplace appropriate discussion. And yet what I hear from people frequently, Jane, and I should be clearer here, men, usually older men, is, well, listen, lots of people meet their spouses in the workplace. I have a response to this. I'd like you to have a shot at responding to this. Horse pucky, my little editorial there.
I'll wrap the bow around it with this. I don't remember how I got out of that situation. All I know is that he did not come home to my apartment with me that night.
Yes.
And when I went into work the next day, I went to our head of human resources.
You did.
A friend of mine, a woman, and I told her what had happened the night before, and her response was, oh my gosh, we've been having an affair for the last couple of months.
Oh, get around, guy. Wow, I wonder how many times he laid that line on women that worked for him or with him.
But
pretty shocking.
I went to HR for some kind of resolution, and she admits to me that she is already sleeping with him. And she's like, well, I can't do anything with this. I can't take it up the
Because
the
you're sleeping with him. Like,
yes.
Who, dear human resources professionals, most of you are quite excellent, but there are a few of you who are terrible, and your terribleness has a trickle-down terribleness impact. Like, when you compromise your own judgment, and frankly, this is a lot like lawyers in big organizations and the lawyer client, like, there was, you can't have your judgment compromised in any way, shape, or form like that, because no client, no employee coming to you in human resources is going to feel confident in your ability to fairly and objectively address what is, by any current measure, not a good thing in the workplace. Folks, yeah, go ahead, Jane, please.
I will tell you what I was told when I suggested I was going to bring a lawsuit. We'll wrap that up on the other side.
What was Jane told when she said she might bring a lawsuit after being propositioned by her boss a few years back in radio? We continue this discussion of women in the media with my colleague and friend, Jane Matinair, host of Matinair on Air, 10 to noon every Monday through Friday. I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to the Civic Media Radio Network. Keep it locked. Happy Women's History Month, everybody.
You're listening to Civic Media. Find the latest news, information, and archives of all your favorite shows on the Civic Media website, civicmedia.us.
Be every woman, but we're a relevant sample size. Folks, my name's Maggie Dawn. You're listening to The Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. Got my good friend and colleague in broadcasting, Jane Matinair, hostess with the mostest. She's got that great show from 10 to noon every Monday through Friday right here on the Civic Media Radio Network. We've been talking about what's it like to be a woman in media, especially over the arc of Jane's incredibly, I think, groundbreaking, historic, and important career. I stand on your shoulders, Jane. Thank you for making what many of us new women in broadcasting, what we're able to do is in part because of the trailblazing that you did and, frankly, some of the crap that you put up with. Before the break, we were talking about one such incident where your boss basically propositioned you. It was ostensibly a business dinner, very almost cliched circumstances. You, again, I talk about it in a very literal sense, tap danced, joked your way out of that circumstance, reported it to HR the next day, only to find out that your HR director was sleeping with the same guy for some more months, who, by the way, was married. So all's well that ends well, I guess not. You were just saying before the break that you took a couple of other steps and the reaction was equally eyebrow raising.
Well,
you tell, Jane.
So I go to HR and she tells me that she's already sleeping with him and she can't take it to higher management, obviously, because she's involved with him. And I'm like, well, what options do I have now? Because I am concerned about retaliation because I rejected him in a very happy, you know, in a very happy tap dancey kind of way, but I still rejected him. And so I talked to several people about filing a lawsuit. And what I was told was, sure, you can do that and you'll get a settlement and you will never get another job in radio because you are a troublemaker.
I cannot tell people how prevalent that threat is in nearly innumerable categories of work and industries. I will tell you this to an absolute certainty because I know, based on some of the experiences that some of my friends had, Big Law, which is these huge international law firms, mostly based, at least their headquarters are all in New York City. There is a reason that people in pop culture have basically never heard of any employees in big law and big finance. Think Goldman Sachs, Solomon Brothers, Merrill Lynch, all of that stuff.
Yep.
You've never heard of big employee class actions because people get blackballed and you'll never work in that industry again. It is a common problem. We were talking a little bit, Jane, about how sometimes, again, being met when stories are shared, sometimes with male colleagues or about women being propositioned in the workplace, well, just say no, you don't need to worry about it. Or what's the big deal? People meet spouses in the workplace all the time. My general response is two things. If you are at all in a boss subordinate, there is never any circumstance under which that relationship is appropriate, including if the subordinate initiates said relationship with the boss. It's never okay. Here's another hot tip. Write it down if you need to. Generally, not a good idea to comment on physical characteristics of your coworkers, even if it's
meant
that
in the
looks
nicest
very
way
nice
possible.
On you.
Right.
Correct.
Right.
Like it's slippery slope. The most, hey, you look great today. Maybe the best, but even that, like, better idea, just say nothing. The other thing I've heard a lot of, Jane, and I was wondering if you could comment on this, is from men who have long time, very, very experienced in particular industries. Well, I know lots of women. I've never heard that from them. I've never seen anything like this during my 35 right. years in blankety blank industry. Your
I can,
thoughts?
Okay. It's interesting that you say that because this happened within, I would say, the last year. I ran into someone who I worked with at that same radio station when this happened. And that limo on a fruit plate joke that I've been using for years now, which was my jokey way out of this very uncomfortable situation with the boss who had propositioned me, I ran into this guy that I used to work with at this radio station, and he said, I love that limo on a fruit plate line. It just makes me laugh every time. And I said, do you know where that comes from? And I told him the story, and he said, oh, wow, I didn't know anything about that. Well, you know, he was always really good to me. He was always really good to me. And that's where I think it's important that people realize your experience going through life does matter on your gender and your race and how you are perceived. Just because your experience is one thing within this industry does not mean that everyone else has that same experience.
It's interesting. This has come up for me, Jane, in the context of confirmation hearings, because what is often expressed by man, and it's almost always a man, accused of set of inappropriate sexual behaviors is, oh, but I have 150 letters from women I've worked with
yep.
or in my life that say I'm all a good dude. And I'm like, again, just because that woman didn't experience it, or those women, doesn't mean that this other woman who you were a creep to and perceived some vulnerability or power asymmetry that you wanted to exploit didn't experience it. Remember, the height of privilege is thinking that your experience defines the entire universe of experience, and therefore something that someone is sharing doesn't exist or isn't a problem. Jane, will you come back very soon? Because I would love to have a longer conversation with you about
this. I would
stuff.
Love to. And anybody listening out there, don't do what I did. You sue them. You take
sue
them to court and you sue them.
Because we're all, every woman, my great thanks to my great colleague, Jane Matinair, host of Matinair on Air, 10 to noon every Monday through Friday. I'm going to come back with a special edition of Women in the Media for Women's History Month here on the Civic Media Radio Network. Keep it locked.
The national news cycle never stops, but it can be hard to find news about your local community. Civic Media is dedicated to providing quality local and state news coverage across Wisconsin. With the Civic Media app, you can get notifications about local stories that matter to you and your community. Find the free Civic Media app in your phone's app store and choose notifications from the menu to tell us what kind of news you want to hear about.